Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Welcome to the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Joining me is Dominic Salvatore, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Director of the PhD Program in Economics at Fordham University. He has written the leading text on international economics. He has been an advisor in China, an advisor to the Vatican. In fact, I know more about him than I'm allowed to say, but let me just say he has some very prestigious positions in international economics, and I'm delighted that he is here with us. He is a consultant to the UN, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and several other corporations and banks. Dr. Salvatore is honorary professor at the Shanghai Finance University and Hunan University, and was a visiting professor at the universities in Rome, Cairo, Pretoria, Beijing, and Vienna. He's a fellow of the New York Academy of Sciences, among many, many other titles and honors. I'm not going to read them all, Doctor, because I think if I do, there'll be no time left for me to ask any questions.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And so let me start by saying, what is going on with the euro?
Well, the euro is in trouble, as we know. Europe is in trouble, as we know. But there are two immediate problems and one fundamental problem with the euro. The two immediate problems is the first one, Europe, especially Southern Europe, or the gypsies, not the pigs. It's Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy. They have overborrowed, and now they cannot service their debt. That's the first problem. The second problem is that they cannot compete. They lost competitiveness, and I'll go back to each of these. But even if those two problems were resolved, there would still remain the fundamental problem of the euro. So to begin with, the debt, the sovereign debt. When the euro was created, before the euro was created, the interest paid on the debt of these weak countries, these five countries, was high, much higher than Germany or Northern Europe was paying on its debt. When the euro was created, the financial markets started to feel that a sovereign debt or a government debt from Greece was as risky or as little risky as a German debt or a German bond. Therefore, the interest rate on government debt of these countries became the same as those of Northern Europe and Germany, became much lower. That encouraged them to borrow a great deal. Then Lehman Brothers came, and the markets, the financial markets, realized that a debt of these weak countries was much more risky than the debt of Germany. The interest rate once again became much higher than in Germany or in the other Nordic country, and that made that debt unsustainable. Unsustainable, the markets feel that when the interest rate on the 10-year bond begins to reach 7% or go above 7%, the debt is no longer sustainable. And this is what happened in 2010 to Greece and Ireland. And in 2011, it happened in Portugal. And now it's close to happen to Spain. And after Spain goes, it would be Italy. And after Italy goes, it would be France. France is not too far off. So now the interest rate on the 10-year bonds, Spanish bonds, exceeds 7%. That's the trigger where Spain very likely will have to default, just like Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. So that's the first problem. But even if that problem disappeared, now I came back, I was in the past 2 months, I was 1 month in China, 3 weeks in South Africa, 1 week in Europe, and I happened to be in Europe when the debt was renegotiated, they were discussing about this problem of the sovereign debt. This is the first problem, unsustainable. So Spain is at the verge of having to be rescued. And it may happen next month, but almost with certainty by autumn. it will happen. And as I said, after Spain, you know, financial markets always attack the weakest link. And when the weakest link falls, then they go to the next, and then the next, and so on. But even if that debt disappeared, so I was in Mondale, the Nobel Prize winner, the euro, the father of the euro. I wrote, Mondale was not getting the Nobel because of personal reasons, which we shall not say publicly. Eventually, he got the Nobel. We are delighted. And I invited him to the American Economic Association with five other Nobels. And I wrote an introduction to the special issue of the Journal of Policy Modeling. I said three brilliant ideas. One, Nobel, Robert Mondale. I should be a poet. In other words, he did three things, each of which deserved the Nobel. Now, every year, he has a conference in Siena. He has a palace in Siena. And he has a conference, closed doors, no newspapers, no news media, nothing. And you have the top people. This year we had Paul Volcker, there was Trichet. They were all the top people, but of course. And Mondale, we got into a heated argument because he is of the view that the only problem of Europe was this sovereign debt, unsustainable. And I said, and I think the people participating had to agree, I said, even if that debt disappeared, the second problem would remain. Europe is, or those weak countries, are non-competitive. They cannot compete. And we are not discussing opinions. Opinions, we should know theory, and we should know facts, and then we discuss. Now, it's when people are wrong based on theory, it's easy to knock them down. When people do not know the facts, sometimes they continue to discuss. Well, the facts are clear. From 2000 to 2010, the unit cost of labor in those five countries, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, increased vis-a-vis the German unit labor cost by 30 or 40%. They cannot compete. But this is something new. In 1995, it was Germany that was the sick man of Europe. In 1995, unit labor cost in Germany was 30 or 40% higher than in these countries, the now weak countries. But Germany put its house in order, restructured its economy, contained labor cost increases, and reacquired competitiveness. So by the year 2000, see in 1995, German unit labor costs were 30, 40% higher than these five countries. In 2000, it was equal. Today, it's 30 or 40% below. Now, I cannot understand. You see, monetary people think money is everything. Money is crucial. Money is important, but it's not everything. We have the financial sector and we have the real sector. Europe cannot compete, period. And there are some horror stories which are, if they were not true, it would be a joke. If you are a train conductor in Greece, you earn net of taxes 7,000 euros per month. Now, 7,000 euros per month at that time was $10,000 per month, tax-free, which means that with taxes, it was $14,000 per month. The year has 13 months, not 12. If you go to work on time, you earn 350 euros more per month. If you the time that you go to work is counted as work time. And they want to retire at 57, and have the same pension as Germans who retire at 67. So the point is, they are non-competitive. So even if that sovereign debt by a miracle disappeared, the fact would remain that these countries are sick, the real sector, they cannot compete. And what is incredible, Alan, what is incredible is that when I discuss in these countries, I look at myself in the mirror, so two other, either I'm crazy or these people are crazy. I say, the only way that you can get wage increases is to earn them through productivity increases. If your productivity increases by 3%, you can increase your wages by 3% without increasing unit labor costs. You do not lose competitiveness and productivity. But if you increase wages 10% and productivity increases by 5%, Or if productivity increases by zero, like in Italy, and the wage increases by 3%, those increase unit labor cost, you lose international competitiveness, period. I'm a consultant to the central bank, they call it the Reserve Bank of South Africa. I'm an honorary professor also at Pretoria. They just took 2 years to process the paper, but now I haven't updated. And Zuma said, and I said this last year, Zuma said, the president said, I will increase the wages of everyone in the country by 15%. So I told them, since you are at it, why don't you increase it 50%? So he was shocked. I said, why are you shocked? I mean, we wish it were just a matter of a signature. I mean, why increase it 15%? Because everyone is poor. Too many people are poor. That's a laudable aim, but that is not. So why? Well, because you can only earn wage increases without harming yourself, losing productivity, losing competitiveness. You can only earn it through. The labor unions in South Africa say, we don't care about productivity. What do you mean you don't care? And no one can say this because the party of Zuma has labor unions which are not enlightened, and the Communist Party, and so on. So they say, we negotiate wages, we don't care about productivity. I say, for you, and you know, I'm also a member of the National Planning Commission of South Africa, and the National Planning Commission is all people who believe that. I say, to be an enlightened labor union means that you work together with business to improve productivity and earn your wage increases. Otherwise, you will not get anywhere. You just reduce. So these, the problem would remain. But there is a fundamental problem which goes at the very heart of the euro. And that is the problem that every time they make a step to solve what they consider a problem, eventually it turns out not to be a problem. Parenthetically, I was in Europe exactly when Greece had to decide whether to stay in the euro or get out. And in Europe, all the newspapers, all the news programs, and in the United States, I was reading on the iPad, they said there was a big debate. I said a week before the vote, I stake my professional reputation. I wish it were so easy to do things or to say things. Greece will stay in the euro. Who the hell is going to give them 100 billion euros per year to subsidize them if they get out of the euro? Nobody. They want to stay. They want the 100 billion euros and then renegotiate or never repay. If the Germans think that those are loans, they can forget about it. Those are not loans. Those are grants. So they can forget about it. Okay. Then the spread between Spanish 10-year debt and the German debt reached the crisis level. And they thought, after they agreed to move toward the banking union, they agreed to refinance Spanish banks. And suddenly, the spread declined, and seemingly, the crisis was over. I wrote an article in the American Economic Review, a short article, no technical things, a short article in May 1997, before the creation of the euro. And I said at the time, there is a fundamental problem that the euro, and it will haunt them forever. And the fundamental problem is as follows. Suppose that the Northeast and the United States is in a recession, asymmetrically with the rest of the country. So the Northeast is in recession, the rest of this country is not in recession. What happens? So the Northeast cannot do monetary policy. It's the Fed that does monetary policy for the entire country. The Northeast cannot do fiscal policy because most states, except Vermont, in their constitution, they have to balance the budget each year. So they cannot do expansionary fiscal policy on a statewide level. They cannot do exchange rate policy because the dollar is the currency for the entire country. But there is an escape hatch for the Northeast being in a recession. And what is? Labor movement. There is labor mobility. From the Northeast, you don't find jobs here. If the Northeast only is in a recession, people move. There is a great deal of mobility. The degree of mobility in the U.S. labor market is 3 or 4 times higher than in Europe. So there is an escape hatch for the Northeast. Then there is fiscal redistribution. Who pays for unemployment insurance? It's not the state, it's the federal government. So there is fiscal redistribution in favor of the Northeast. So now the Northeast cannot do monetary policy, cannot do fiscal policy, cannot do exchange rate policy, but there is an escape hatch. There is a way to overcome, in a sense, the crisis or the pressure by labor mobility and by fiscal redistribution. In Europe, this does not exist. There is only monetary union. There is no fiscal and no redistribution. So now Greece is in a recession. Greece, like the Northeast, cannot do monetary policy because it's the European Central Bank. It cannot do fiscal policy because it already has huge debt. And Greece lied. Greece is not Ireland. Ireland is a serious country. It got into trouble. Greece was lying at the government level. They said that the extent of their deficit in relation to GDP was 5%. It wasn't 8%. It wasn't 10%. It wasn't 15%. It was above 15%. The nation was lying. Okay, so Greece cannot do fiscal policy, already exceeded, cannot do monetary policy, cannot do exchange rate policy. But Greeks cannot move easily. There is a labor economist who said to me, what do you mean there is no labor mobility in Europe? Look at the hundreds of thousands of people that moved from Portugal or Turkey to the European Union. And this is a labor economist? What kind of, where did he study? Mobility means at every level, every professional level. The people who move in Europe are the unskilled and only the unskilled. That's not mobility. That is, mobility means that a lawyer, a doctor, it's not easy even in the United, but they can move here. They don't and they cannot because of language, because of all sorts of things. The fact remains. Then the budget of the European Union is 1.5% of GDP. Most of it used to finance or to subsidize agriculture. So there is no possibility of redistribution. So now, either Greece restructures its economy, which means lowering wages by 30, 40%. They are living beyond their means. And they are borrowed. And they don't want to restructure. Estonia did it. Latvia did it. Lithuania did it. They had excessive deficit. And this comes Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman says, look what happened in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. They were in a crisis. They went for austerity, and they had 18% unemployment. Well, the president of Estonia answered, says, Mr. Krugman, you may have all the Nobel Prize you want, but this is not what happened in Estonia. In Estonia, it was not austerity that created the problem. Estonia got into a recession because there were no more capital coming in. In other words, Europe got into recession, in trouble, financial. Estonia could not receive any more capital, no bank loans, no, nothing. That caused the recession. Because of the recession, real GDP fell, the government revenues declined, and that's when they had to reduce expenditures in order to come back to austerity, come back to become a virtue. So it was not that when the crisis came and greater unemployment because of austerity. No, the crisis came for other reasons, and austerity was the cause of the crisis and then was the result of the crisis that. So, and I mean, he's the president, and Krugman has not answered that. And of course, he suggests that we do the same. Now, notice the difference with Southern Europe. While Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania put their house in order, are a great sacrifice. And now they are growing very rapidly, more rapidly than any other country in Europe. The southern European countries or the countries in trouble only went to have more debt, and we know what happens, but we'll come back to that. So what happens now? Unless Europe moves toward full fiscal and political integration, they will forever have problem. In other words, they take steps to solve the immediate problem, but that problem will come back because of the fundamental flaw. Unless there is complete fiscal and political unification, the same as monetary unification, all of these steps will only postpone. We will have a series, continued series of crises. No, so what will happen? Either they move finally to full political and fiscal integration, or it will fall. And all of these steps taken are palliatives. They are an aspirin taken along the way to address the symptoms and not the causes of the problem. Now, is Europe prepared to be politically integrated and fiscally integrated? I'm not sure. Even France does not want. England, of course, not part of the euro, certainly does not want that. But that is, so every time, this explains that every time they do steps, it solves, it pacifies the market temporarily, and then it comes again and again and again. You know what we should do, Alan? We should keep people to their predictions. In other words, if you make predictions and you are wrong all the time, I don't want to listen to you. We do not want to listen. And I have to repeat what I've said about Rubini. Rubini stated, I predicted the crisis. Well, I mean, he didn't predict anything, but we'll come to that. The point is, if he really predicted the crisis, we want to listen because he knows what most other people did not know. But Rubini, I said, Mr. Rubini, you predicted a crisis. You tell me where I'm wrong and I will stop saying it and I will stop writing about it. To make a prediction, you must tell me the timing and the reason. You cannot say we're going to have a crisis. As day follows night, we are going to have crises. You have to tell me when a crisis comes and the reason. And if you miss one or the other or both, you predicted nothing. So now we come. What did you say? In 2004, you said the crisis was imminent. On my dictionary, imminent doesn't mean necessarily today, this week, but it means within a month, within 6 months. And the reason, you said, of the crisis was the dollar would collapse in 2004. A crisis that was possible then, a crisis which is possible now, but it's not the crisis that came. Then in 2006, you said again, a crisis is imminent. This time, the reason was the shooting up of primary commodity prices, especially petroleum prices, if you remember, which didn't come. Then in 2007, you woke up, it's like I woke up today, it was cloudy. I said, it's cloudy. We all knew in 2007 that a crisis was coming, and we knew where it was coming from. So, Mr. Rubini, you predicted nothing, okay? So now I repeat what I said. And again, you don't have to take my view, but this is exactly what has happened. There are people who go around make analyses which are wrong from one side or the other. You see, they say that economics is the dismal science. No, we have fun. When you hear these things, we have fun. I mean, you hear things that are completely, completely wrong. To have correct economic analysis, you need three things. One, you need to have profound knowledge of theory. Theory is like the GPS. Without theory, you are groping in the dark. Theory tells you the direction. But you also need to know the real world, because often the real world does not work as theory postulates. And then you have to have a little common sense. Now, you have many economists who know all of the equations, and I've done, and I know all the equations, so I don't know. And they are proud not to know anything about the real world. They don't dirty their hands with the real world. This is a social science. This is not pure physics. Let not the economists who feign themselves as mathematical economists. Those are the people who, many of them, flunked in mathematics. I practically am an engineer, so I know mathematics, but that is a servant. It should not be the aim. Then you have the business economists who cannot look any further than their noses. You know, they look at the charts, they extend charts. It's like they live in a fog. You know, you only see this far. So you need both, but then you need a little common sense. And a little common sense, many people in our profession lack many common sense. You have pessimists. Pessimists are ugly people. You know, they always predict crises, Dr. Doom, always. But to my definition of a pessimist is not one who predicts dooms, only predicts dooms. The real pessimist is one who, when the crisis that he or she always predicts doesn't come, instead of being happy to be wrong, they are more unhappy because they thrive on crises. So this is where Paul Krugman, 2002, New York Times, he writes, the United States is going back into recession, double dip, which didn't come. The U.S. was in recession, shallow recession in 2001. 2003, the United States is going back into recession, double dip. So I wrote an article saying, you know, there are many Cassandras in the world. One of the most listened to is Paul Krugman, who made this prediction. But he did not make a prediction, maybe. I said these words. He has a direct line with God. He knows what we common mortals do not know. But the did not come. But look, once again, these are mistakes that should not have been made, not after the event. I wrote an article saying, I don't think the United States goes back into recession for the following reason. During recession or slow growth, labor productivity collapses. In the United States in 2002 or 2003, labor productivity continued to increase, which meant that the real sector was not sick in this economy. It was excesses in the financial sector which needed correction, and that's why the crisis came. So all we're saying is we don't want to be nasty people to attribute you were wrong. No, I'm attributing people who were wrong, who should not have been wrong, because we said so. Look at Trichet, July 2008. He says explicitly, I'm going to increase interest rate in Europe because we are worried about inflation. Because people who worry about a recession, they don't know what they're talking about. Because Europe is so large, so autonomous, he had never heard the word interdependence, that even if the United States and the rest of the world goes into recession, Europe will avoid a recession. Can you believe this? Then in April 2011, when it was already in recession, and July 2011, he increases the interest rate worrying about inflation, when in fact, it was the recession that continued. These are mistakes that should not have been made. So again, we don't want to be nasty. We want to know if you made these glorious mistakes, I don't want to listen to you. So to repeat then, to go back to the question, thank you for allowing me this excursion.
I'm delighted.
So once there is a sovereign debt, they overborrowed. And how they got to it? When the Lehman Brothers failed and interest rates once again shot up, what was sustainable at low rates of 4% are not sustainable at 7% that they had to pay. Even if that debt disappeared by a miracle, they are non-competitive. They cannot compete and they cannot devalue because they have the same currency. They have to do internal devaluation, as Estonia did. But both of these problems are passing problems, or could be passing problems. The fundamental problem is that they will haunt them forever until they move to full fiscal and political union, which many of them do not want. So, as I've said, this analysis, Mondale can have, he's a friend, he's a good friend, he can have all the Nobels he wants, but he's, I mean, he's wrong on this. There is a real economy aspect, and he is the father of the euro. If anything, he said all the reasons why the euro could not work. He said for the euro to work, we have to have a great deal of labor mobility and we have to have fiscal redistribution. How do you argue against the theory and the facts? Either they do not know the theory or they do not know the facts or they are not balanced in their views. But
we are, of course, listening here at the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to the fabulous, and I'm sure you'll all admit that, Dominic Salvatore, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Director of the PhD Program in Economics at Fordham University, and advises many people. So in the United States, if you take a look, Professor, at the way in which this country developed, we had all these states, we had reserve powers for the various states. Is there any comparability with what you're talking about now?
I will read the quotation, and I will not tell you, this is the only quotation I will read. I will not tell you who said it until I finish. It's a short quotation. The budget should be balanced. The treasury should be refilled. Public debt should be reduced. The arrogance of officialdom should be tempered and controlled, and the assistance to foreign lands should be curtailed. Now I'll give it away. Lest Rome become bankrupt, people must again learn to work instead of living off public assistance. Cicero, 1555 BC, 55 years before the birth of Christ.
And here I was going to say Alexander Hamilton.
But no, well, of course, this is a recurring. Now, if someone had told me 4 or 5 years ago, there is a country which has a deficit to GDP, the ratio of budget deficit to GDP, which is 8, 9, 10%, and a national debt which exceeds the GDP, I would have thought of Portugal, some other country. This is the United States. We have become a non-virtuous country. In 2006, the national debt was 67% of GDP. In 2011, was 103%. This year will be 108%. The deficit in relation to GDP in 2006 in the United States was 2%. In 2007 was 3%. In 2008 was 6%. In 2009, 11.7%. In 2010, 10.7%. In 2011, 9.6%. This year, 8-point-something%. We are no longer a virtuous country. We are on a non-sustainable level. The only difference between we and Europe at this stage, well, there are two major differences. One is that we have a true union, economic union, common monetary, fiscal, and political union. That is why Europe, that's what saves us, still saves us. Okay, and secondly, we do not live on entitlements like Europe does. In Europe, in Europe, there is more social cohesion. Yes, because everyone expects the government to take care of them from birth to death. In other words, you have guaranteed vacations. Even if you retire, the government pays you for guaranteed vacations to a spa for 2 weeks, everybody. We have free health care. We have free education. We have everything free. And in fact, one lady, I was in Italy when there was 1 meter, 3 feet of snow. And this lady came on television and said, can you, she lived at 5,000 feet in a small town, 5,000 feet above sea level, 1,500 meters. And she said, look at the government. It snowed, it's 24 hours, and I'm still stuck here. In other words, the government has to provide everything and everywhere. When I came to this country, I was 16. I asked my father, why did we go? And he answered, so you and your brother could study. So why, people in Europe don't study? He says, yeah, but that is the country for young people. That is the country of optimism. That is the country of the future. That is the country which is dynamics. That is a country that is different from every other country. Now, when I came, of course, it was more true than it is today, because unfortunately, because of the crisis that we have, that will be a major, major. So today we are in trouble. We are in trouble because, notice, 4 years after the peak level of employment in 2007, 4 years later, 48 months later, we still have 4 percentage points of unemployment that is unresolved. In other words, our level of unemployment now could be something like 4.5%. It is 8.2% if we do not include people who work part-time who would like to work full-time, if we do not include the people who are discouraged because they don't find jobs. If we included those things, and these are not my data, this is government data, the level of unemployment would be more like 14.9%. So now, 4 years after the peak, now comparing this recession with previous ones. Now, the previous one in 2001 was a shallow recession. The loss of jobs was 2 percentage points, but it took 4 years to go back to the peak level of employment. So we lost 2%. But we recuperated, and it took 4 years. The previous deepest recession prior to this one was the 1981. The 1981, we lost 3 percentage points of employment. But after 24 months, 2 years, we had gone back to the peak level of employment. It was a deep recession, but it was a recession of the real sector. Those recessions are easier in a sense. They come, they can be very deep, but can be more easily corrected. Now, we, after 2 years, we had lost 6.5 percentage points of employment. Sometimes, you know, even the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times, they ought to know the difference between percent and percentage points. In other words, if you go, if the, say, the growth goes from 2 to 3%, I can quote Wall Street Journal, and they say the growth increased by 1%. My friend, 1% from 2% is 2.02. From 2 to 3% is 1 percentage point. Also, they ought to also know to learn a little grammar. Now, I'm not here to talk about grammar. The Wall Street Journal, 2 months ago, who, the top, the front page, who do we ask? No, my friend, whom do we ask? The subject and the predicate, it's unbelievable. In other words, once Paul Krugman wrote an article in The Economist using who and whom perfectly, except in reverse. Whatever, I mean, the language is to be precise. I mean, let's, but these are, my wife says, you are worried even about these things. Yes, I have my, if I only worried about little things, and these are not little things, then I'm a small mind. But I have enough capability to look at the deep things and also little things, okay? So I walk, whom do we have? So we are, and now we are in a bad predicament. We know the fiscal cliff. Much has been written about this. If we do nothing, and with the political paralysis, very likely, we will do nothing until the election in November. If we do nothing, the Bush tax cuts will expire. And we have, in renewing the debt or increasing the debt, we agreed that there are some reduction in expenditures. So if we do nothing, and we are likely to do nothing until the election in November, we will be, according to the Congressional Budget Office, in a recession the first half of 2013 with a loss of GDP of 1.5% about. And then in the second half of 2013, growth will resume about 2%, leaving a net growth for the entire year of half of 1%. If we instead allow those Bush tax cuts to continue, and we do not reduce expenditures, the growth rate in the first half of the year, again, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which is neutral, would be about 4.5% in the first half, 3.5% in the second half of 2013, with a net growth of 4% for the year. However, if we allow the Bush tax cut to continue, and we do not reduce expenditures so that we grow on an average of 4%, the national debt will increase by $1.2 trillion as opposed to $600 billion if we allow them to expire. So we are in a predicament. So now the question is, and now comes on dangerous political ground. The question now is, what do we do? Of course, Paul Krugman and some others would want us to say, we have an immediate problem now, we have to solve the immediate problem. Don't reduce expenditures and don't let the tax cut, at least for some people, not expire. However, then you have a person like Kenneth Rogoff from Harvard who says, that's enough. You know, the ugly expert kick the can. We have an immediate problem of unsustainable debt, not in the future. We have it now. The only way we are different from Europe is because we are a political and fiscal union in addition to a monetary union. Otherwise, we'd be exactly in the trouble that Europe is. But we cannot push this too far. We have a budget deficit of over 8%. And you say we should spend more. Well, there is a wonderful, not because I agree with it, but there is a wonderful paper written at the European Central Bank that says the following. We studied Europe, and we're not Europe. Until the debt in relation to GDP reaches 65-70%, any stimulus package will have a positive impact, will be good. between 70% to 100% of the debt, any fiscal stimulus will be washed out, will be no effect. When the debt is above 100%, a fiscal stimulus package will actually be harmful. Europe is in that situation. So we are in this predicament. Now, one way perhaps to overdo, to do this is to agree that maybe we need a stimulus package now, but we must agree now on the future trend of expenditures which are non-sustainable. No one wants to reduce anything. We, of course, don't want to reduce expenditures on education. We don't want to reduce expenditures on health. We don't want to reduce expenditure on the military. So we would have to agree now on a projection of these debts to become, and there is a big, big, big job, because we are not just a little over. We're not by master criteria 3% deficit to GDP. But where did they get that 3%? You know where they got that 3% that Europe should not go above 3% of GDP? Because they expect it to grow at 3%. So if your deficit increases at 3% of GDP and your GDP grows at 3%, the ratio, the debt to GDP ratio, remains constant. But Europe was not growing at 3%. So even 3% deficit was unsustainable. Now, we grew at 3%, but we have a deficit of 8%. So this is the predicament we face now. And so people say, if you continue to spend like this, the markets. But then one question that I would solicit, if you deem so, I mean, I don't want to, why is the U.S. not growing? And there is a whole list of things why the United States is not growing. And I was asked before, what should a young person expect? Well, I mean, we're not the purveyor of bad news. We don't want to be, we're not pessimists. But we are not going to grow. We are not going to resolve this problem in a year or two or three. And this is terrible. The biggest damage that this recession is doing, it is changing the very nature of this country. When you have young people that for 3 or 4 years, they have studied, they, under normal condition, they would expect to have a job, not any job, a job commensurate to the training. There was once, many years ago, the New York State Commissioner of Labor, whatever, says, I don't see any unemployed PhDs. PhDs, English PhDs who drive a taxi, are unemployed, are structurally unemployed. You know, they are doing things. You don't have to have a PhD in English to drive a taxi. If you drive a taxi, you have a job. But that's not the job for which you trained. And that's so now, this is the first time that you have a whole years of the people who graduate who were expected to find jobs which were appropriate for the level, not their exaggerated level of expectations, but appropriate for the, and they don't. And you have people on part-time, people who get discouraged. And this is, I think this is the most damaging aspect of this recession. In the past, you had recessions, you sprung back. The 2001, we did not spring back quickly, but the depth of the recession was not as serious as this one. This is a different recession. It's financial recession together with economics. I know we take longer, but this is taking. We are 4 percentage points, 6, 7, 8 million people. We are creating not even enough jobs to hire, to employ the new entrants into the labor force. You know, in the first quarter, we averaged 226,000 jobs per month. Our labor force grows 120,000, 130,000. So, but even then, that is 130 would employ the new entrants into the labor force, leaving 120,000 each month to absorb the previous unemployed. Now, but we have to absorb 6 to 8 million. Imagine how many months, how many years you need to do that, even under those conditions. But in the past quarter, we added 75,000 jobs per month, when each month we, and our economy is slowing down again. By the way, the stimulus package of $831 billion that we've had. Now, we have all people, we have to be fair and balanced. You know, conservatives say that has not been any, look how people talk past one another. A conservative says that did not live to expectations. $831 billion was supposed to, we were told, keep the maximum level of unemployment to 8%. It went to over 10, and now we should be at 6% unemployment. We are over 8, okay? So it did not live up to. But the left says without that stimulus package, we'd be in much worse conditions, of course. But look, what people say things. Of course, you spent $830 billion. What did you do with that? You had to give it. You had to spend it. Of course it would create some jobs. That it would create some jobs, it goes without saying. What did you do with $830 billion? Dig a ditch? Even that you have to pay people to dig the ditch and create some jobs. So, of course, that's a silly thing to say. Yes, it created jobs. It would have been worse. And let's give due credit when due. At the depth of the crisis, we did not know how the economy was going to go. So it was perfectly legitimate to think we could go into a depression, right? So now, you know, we cannot go back and say it was all wrong because almost it's like going into Iraq. Everybody agreed to go into Iraq into this country, almost everybody. Not everybody, but I mean Clinton, a lot of people in high places agreed, left and right, Democrats and Republicans agreed. So even now, if there was a Republican, probably one would have had to go into some stimulus package. However, $830 billion, $831 billion plus quantitative easing, we went from 5% of GDP, that is, the holdings of financial instruments by the central bank to 20% of GDP. So now if you add those 15 percentage points of quantitative easing in relation to GDP plus the $831 billion, we have over $3 billion. You know, $3 billion have no common reference for us. You know what $2 trillion is? If you spend $1 million per day since the time 2,000 years ago to today, we would spend $2 trillion. If you spend $1 million each day, after 2,000 years, you would have spent $2 trillion. That's how much money it is. So we spend that much. We are much less. Then, but there are fundamental reasons why we do not grow. If our chair agrees, we can go to discuss that. Why is this country not growing and other countries not growing?
Well, you can use whatever time you want to take as long as it's in the next 9 minutes and a quarter.
It is. That's
we've gone.
Oh,
through.
My God. We wish this was the time as our
end. Professor, you haven't mentioned the word China. I know you're a China expert. You're there all the time. You're an advisor to the government. How are they doing?
Well, when I've been in China for, everybody goes to China now. I've been in China since 1987 for almost every year, except for a few years, for a month. I have the two leading texts in China, International Economics and Managerial Economics in a Global Economy. As Mr. Shartok said, I'm honorary professor at the University of Shanghai, Hunan University. I teach at Peking University. I know China as much as 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people were saying, we don't believe China's growth rates. They are fake. And now, my professor, Lawrence Klein, the great, I mean, we now have Nobels and Nobels, you know. You have the really true giants, Nobels, and then you have Nobels that, frankly, I spoke to Paul Samuelson 6 months before he died, and I said, what about this year's Nobel? I said, either two other things, either I'm ignorant or I've never read, I've never heard this person's name. Paul Simon said, I haven't heard there either. So you had Nobels and Nobels, you know. But Lawrence Klein studied this, and I was, for 20 years, I worked with him at the United Nations. And instead of having a report on population growth and economic growth that stands on a shelf, I had the book for Oxford University Press on economic growth and income distribution. Which was voted, that's why I say, the best book in income distribution in the past 20 years. I've written with my colleague, who also was here, Fred Campano. So I know something about income distribution. So when Paul Krugman writes in the New York Times saying things, I know something. So I respond, it's not published. I don't feel bad, because you don't publish some person's comment or article for two reasons. Either the person doesn't count, not everybody can, or the person is completely off base. So when I respond, if I'm wrong, let it be said and show that I'm wrong. But it's not said. Now, coming. So I said, Lawrence Klein found that if anything, the growth rate was underestimated because they looked more at the real sector. The service sector was growing even faster. So China grew at over 10% for 10, 20 years, and it was said it cannot continue. I said China will continue to grow because all the conditions were there. Of course, something can happen, a political upheaval or something can happen. But and why? Because China needs to transfer at least another 300-400 million people who live in subsistence agriculture into the market economy. So there is this transfer is automatically creating growth from subsistence to the market economy. So the conditions are still there. But China's growth is declining. China's growth declined from 10% in 2011. It's going to go, it's said, to 8%, but very likely 7%. Now, people look at these 7% and are bewildered. Yes, there is every reason to be bewildered. 7% means that in 10 years, real GDP doubles. Every 10 years, it doubles at 7% growth. But that's not the way to evaluate China's growth or the growth of any emerging markets. For China, 5, 6% growth is like 0% for us. So for China, and I'll say why, 7, 8% is like 1 or 2% for us. Why? Because China needs 5, 6 percentage points of growth per year to continue to absorb these non-market into the market economy. And also to employ the new college graduates. 5 years ago, if you had an MBA, Peking University is the top, and I am teaching also there at that program. If 5 years ago you had an MBA, as soon as you've graduated, you have five jobs or four or five jobs waiting for you. Now, when you graduate with an MBA from a top school, you have five people looking for one job. And China government knows that people who study, people who sacrifice, people who expect to get jobs, if they don't get jobs, it's political instability. So China's growth rate is declining to a dangerous level. And the government knows that it's now very likely 7% and not 8, as they say, 7%, which is barely enough for China to sustain. China knows, and the government knows, the troubles or the challenges it faces. It faces the creation of jobs and must continue to grow. It faces environmental problems, dangerous environmental problems. I was in Beijing. I could not breathe. I said, well, I don't have breathing problems. I looked at the pollution level, and it's at the maximum level. And I said, well, I was another city. Cairo was not. And then the American embassy has its own monitor in Beijing and said the level of pollution is four times the maximum. not the maximum, four times the maximum. So China knows it has to create jobs, otherwise there is political instability. It has to solve the pollution problem. It has to solve the regional inequalities. So China has its hands full, but it is continuing to grow. But one thing that we are happy, that India also, it started to grow rapidly. In the past, when the monsoon came and agriculture did well, India grew. And when they did not come or they were not heavy, the monsoon rains, India did not grow. And it was embarrassing for us in the West. The largest democracy in the world does not grow. China is not a democracy. In other words, it was almost saying you, in order to grow rapidly, you cannot be at the beginning at least a democracy. Now we are happy that India was growing at 8%. Its rate of growth has declined more to 6 or 5%. So every emerging markets are going is going down. But to conclude, why is the U.S. not growing rapidly? Number one, I will say something that some of you will, can ask. Firms do not invest. The worst thing you can do to a firm is uncertainty. I'm sorry to say, Obama has never been in a business, because had he been in a business, he would know this. The worst thing you can do to a business person is uncertainty. And what uncertainty do we have? We do not know what, it's not Obama's fault entirely. I mean, there is a political impasse. Firms do not know what tax rate they will pay this year. They do not know what is the cost of health expenditure this year. There's nothing. Then we have programs that are 6 months horizon. Firms do not operate that way. So there is uncertainty. Uncertainty, firms do not invest. That's one reason we don't grow. The second is that our tax rate on foreign profits, profits of foreign of corporations abroad, is the highest in the world, 39.5%. We surpassed even Japan, which means that a U.S. multinational has a choice, either repatriate profits and pay almost 40% tax, or reinvest elsewhere, where in Ireland they pay 15%. So they invest abroad. They don't bring some of the... In other words, we don't want to close, but it's not a level playing field. If we had a tax rate on profits 25, 30%, we would have the possibility. So we have uncertainty, too high tax rates on foreign profits, which means they don't bring some of the money back. Third, we are told innovate more. Who created the iPad? We did. How many iPads produced? 60 million. How many iPads produced in the United States? Zero. We cannot blame China for that, because even though 90% come from China, only 10, 20% of the parts and components are made in China. But we innovate, and we don't get the benefit from it. How can we create jobs? Then we have the one, the RMB, which is still undervalued by 20%. China says it's not true, but we have a smoking gun. When your reserves continue to increase, that is the counterpart of the trade deficit. You have a trade deficit, then you accumulate the reserves. So you say that it's not overvalued, it's not undervalued. But if it was not undervalued, you would not have. China has, the United States exports to China $100 billion a year and imports from China $400 billion per year. Now, there is no theory that says that you have to balance your trade bilaterally. But when a country by itself is responsible for over 40% of our trade deficit, something is amiss. Something is out of balance.
We've been listening here at the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to Professor Dominic Salvatore, a distinguished professor of economics and director of the PhD program in economics at Fordham University. Thank you so much. Let's give him a hand for a moment.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.